Hello, you're welcome to episode 5 of the RTE Rugby Podcast, available on rte.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. You could contact us on Twitter at RTE Rugby or Facebook /RTE Sport. Let me just say thanks to everyone who has listened in. We haven't been on the go too long, but apparently there's enough people interested to keep us coming back, so thank you very much. Today, with me are former Ireland forward and world's busiest man, Bernard Jackman, against the head producer and category-leading anthropologist, Wesley Liddy, alongside Michael Glennon and Declan Hooley of the online sports desk. And later on, we'll speak to Alison Donnelly from Scrum Queens, and the extremely ripped Peter Stringer drops in for a chat about what's next for him, all to come. But first, let's hear from the Ireland camp. Damien O'Mara spoke to Ian Henderson and a very happy Jack Carty on the occasion of his first cap.
Yeah, absolutely delighted. There's about 15, 16 people over, so I was just kind of hoping I get on towards the end, and was delighted that for all them travelling over that I eventually did.
I know a lot of players talk about it being a lifelong ambition. A lot of hard work has gone into a day like today. So can you take it in? Can you enjoy it? Or does it go past you in the blink of an eye?
I don't know. I suppose, you're trying to savour it all. Obviously, I was delighted to get on for the couple of minutes, but I suppose when today finishes, I'll soak it all in and then hopefully kind of build towards cap 2 and then 5, and hopefully then I can keep building from that.
There are things you need to go away and look at, and I think just imagine yourselves coming over here to get 5 points and imagine it's going to be easy. It's you're completely incorrect nowadays. Italy have been putting out down performances not only in the club game but in the international game. And I think that getting the 5 points out there is good for us today, and it gives us a lot to think about moving forward.
In terms of the Irish performance, how much did the Italian pressure contribute to what was a slightly more error-strewn performance than we might have seen in recent times?
Yeah, look, we knew they were going to put pressure on. We knew they were going to come off the line hard. We knew they were going to be contesting not only at set piece but in the back line as well. We just needed to make sure we handle that. Probably we didn't handle it maybe as best we could have. We let them clear up a few of our errors. We maybe could have cleared up a few of our own scraps, but like you said, we come away with 5 points and give us stuff to reflect on. It's maybe not a bad thing to kind of ground us a wee bit. Yeah, look, I kind of think one of the things that we've done well over the last number of years is as a team we've been kind of written off a few times, and what we have to be able to do then is put on performances when we've been written off. Now sometimes we go into matches maybe looking like favourites and maybe we're not dealing with that maybe as well as we should, and that could be a work on for us, and I kind of think we just have to, like I said a few minutes ago, have to make sure that we stick to our game and continue doing what we know how to do and what we know how to do right.
Yeah, you get the picture. Bigging up Italy was the initial reaction, Michael.
Yeah, and I don't know if this, I think this ties in maybe with what an Italian journalist said after. It was the first time I'd seen it, was quite funny. Giardini and Conor O'Shea walked into the press conference after the match and they got a round of applause from the Italian media that was assembled there. The press officer said, "We're going to do the first portion of this in Italian," because they were live on TV. And the first journalist that took the mic said, "I'm going to ask this in English because I don't want there to be any misunderstanding." And then this happened.
Hit play.
We played against 16 men rugby. 15, we were 15, they are 16. We knew since Florence that Glenn Jackson is unfit to referee at this level. But I think today, with the fall of Kearney against Ebaldi, not penalized, and with the 7 penalties against Italy to 0 in the first 30 minutes of the second half, he reached the peak of his unability. What do you think?
That was basically, what do you think at the end? And Conor O'Shea said, "I'm just not going to address the referee at all." But it was just funny. I hadn't seen that before, that they would... that he would just unload on the referee and make sure he was...
And have all his colleagues in the Italian media applauding him as well.
That
strikes me as strange, because we all hate each other in the Irish media.
No, that was in advance. So that was just an applause for the captain and coach walking in.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Yeah. Well, that's nice and civilised, isn't it? After all, it is
Birch
sport.
Birch likes having a pop at referees. Get his opinion on it.
I heard that, all right, but...
The old Birch did that, but he got punished, so I'm on good behaviour at the moment. I'm on parole. I didn't think the referee was to be honest, a major player in the game. I didn't think he influenced the contest to the extent. I think he was hard on Italy. In actual fact, I think, you know, for the breakaway try, I thought Earls was pushed. He missed that. You know, there was plenty for both sides to maybe give out about. I don't think it was, you know, I don't think Glenn Jackson cost Italy the game for sure.
No, I don't think so either. Other stories on the website. Now, Declan, you've got some world rankings. We really don't care about world rankings except once every 4 years, but they've been published anyway.
Yeah, they tend to come into sharper focus when it comes to the seedings, like I say, around World Cup time. They've actually been going since 2003, and there was a period, I think, under Eddie's reign when we were kind of rising that we used to take more note of these, but we've kind of...
It was like Top of the Pops in the old days. If Thin Lizzy or the Boomtown Rats were kind of number three, you'd be waiting all week to find out if they made two the next week, but you wouldn't remember that. It's all right.
Not as specifically those artists, but I think I do remember the hype when we beat Australia in 06 and a few other big games at the time where we'd move up a couple of places. But now we've been in second for a while. But I think one thing to note probably with the rankings is you can see, you know, it looks like there's clear divisions at the top of the tree. So at the moment we have New Zealand out on top, and there are a couple of points ahead of Ireland, Wales and England. Now, those three teams really could throw a blanket over in terms of what the IRB see as ranking points. And that'd probably be fair to say our record with the three countries are fairly close. You know, the last 10 years of Ireland v Wales and the Six Nations, Ireland in 2003 was the only time there's been an away victory. Ireland v England's an even split since the last World Cup, two wins each. And Wales...
Didn't we beat them for the Grand Slam, though, in 2009?
We did...
Well, that was over there, wasn't it, to us?
Yeah, that was over there, yeah. That was the final game that was in Cardiff, yeah. But it's just, in, say, 2010, if we go back 10 years, it's only one away win.
Well, one away win
It's one away win, yeah. Gotcha. So the home, it's a home side rule in the roost, which shows the priorities are much between them. And Wales, even Wales v England, has been very little between those teams in recent years. So you look at those three challengers, and then next you've got South Africa, Australia and Scotland in that pecking order. Right. And then you've got the rest, which is France and Fiji and Argentina.
4 years ago, who were top?
So leaning into the World Cup last time around, we had New Zealand and Australia were the top two. And, of course, we know they played in the World Cup final. So at the moment, we're sitting pretty. But we know if Ireland lose to Wales, they're going to leapfrog us. But really, it's those three teams seem
whoever
to be the clear
second
challengers.
Whoever gets to the final, is that what it is?
That is the consistency from the last World Cup cycle anyway, okay. Yeah.
All right, well, we better beat France. So even though we get no points for that because we're at home.
Yes, it's merited to hire. If you're an away team beating a team in a way, there's a lot of criteria involved. But that's what you want to move up the rankings, is an away win against a team above you in the pecking order.
Johnny Holland has been writing on the RTE website about confidence and bringing a few other issues in as well. Do you want to tell me about his column?
Yeah, the column this week, I suppose, is just how teams and individuals deal with confidence. And it's clear that Ireland are lacking that at the moment. You know, we did claim a bonus point victory, but things just aren't running as smoothly. And the point he was making is when things are going well, you're in a state of flow. And he found himself, even though his career as a professional was relatively short, you don't know what's going on. It's just things happen the way they do. And his example was just before he had to call time in his career, he was on 16 penalty kicks in a row, 16 from 16, didn't think about it, slotted them over. He missed one in his second last professional game. And suddenly he said he lost that confidence. It was a scuffed kick. And he goes, for 16, he didn't have to think about it. The next one, he was standing over it and couldn't stop thinking about it in training. Now, he said he was successful, but it goes to show how fickle that line is. It doesn't matter what happens before it. It's sometimes hard to recover that momentum.
We're in studio here. If you get a glass of water there, I'll fill it to the brim and I'll get you to hold it for 5 minutes, no problem. But if I tell you get £1 million for holding it without spilling a drop, you know, I mean, okay, that's an extreme analogy. But like, that's what professional sportsmen are paid to conquer, isn't it?
Yeah, I think these players should have... confidence is different than self-belief. I think, you know, confidence can go with a misplaced kick, but it's having that real strong self-belief to will decide whether you can actually bounce back from it. And I think, you know, this Irish team have a huge amount of players who have massive self-belief, you know. So Johnny Sexton or Conor Murray might be frustrated with the short-term form, but there's no doubt that they went to Rome fully confident that they could you know, win easily, and it was going to be an excellent performance. Unfortunately, it didn't happen, but they'll back themselves to come out against France. I mean, you
so
don't
confidence
lose.
Confidence can evaporate, Bernard, but self-belief is something every time you make a lodgement, it stays in there.
In world
they
class.
They don't think they're bad players now.
100%.
Them.
They'll back themselves.
But they're not performing basic tasks with confidence, but they're not in their private moments saying, well, I'm rubbish
it's
now
all
after
over.
That, you know.
And then with a very young team, they don't have the I suppose the build up of self belief to
maybe their inner chimp isn't mature enough. I don't know about because it. That's what Johnny was saying in his panel.
Like, listen, I don't know. I mean,
context here that Johnny in his piece, which is interesting about his own experiences, mentions this whole kind of phenomenon now that we have to manage the chimp that allegedly dwells in our brain.
Well, he started off there by saying, you know, I wasn't thinking about the place kicks. I was in a state of flow, and you're kind of going. The whole illusion, and this isn't a criticism of him or the players, it's a criticism of kind of the talk that comes around these things. But the whole point of like getting into sports psychology is that it's meant to be, you know, bringing an extra layer to discussion or an extra element of information that maybe we don't understand as onlookers in the public. But yet, the sum total of that extra layer of discussion seems to be, I was in a state of flow and I couldn't understand why. I mean, that's as ridiculous as... The complete opposite
so
of
you've got to deconstruct the success as well as the yips.
But I mean, so the benefit of all this learning and academic research is that you get to a point that you don't understand why you're there. I mean, sure, that seems completely incongruous anyway.
I think if this was a young Irish team with no experience, you'd be worried that, you know, they're saying they're playing with lack of confidence, but they're not a young Irish team who haven't been... The whole trajectory of these players' careers hasn't been smooth. You know,
Do you think, though, if Connor and Johnny particularly are slightly off form or a little consumed with their own form, that when you have injuries in other positions and the average level of experience has come down, that they're such big figures within the team dynamic that their mental state or worrisome state can transmit a little more readily
potentially
than it should?
Yeah, if they're not, I suppose... calming the group. You know, every group needs different stimulus. You know what I mean? So if you have guys who haven't got that experience, so for example, the second row combination, you know, a new partnership at international level, and then you put in Sean Cronin getting his first cap, at his first start, it doesn't really add to the cohesion. The argument would probably be play Rory, maybe, in hindsight for that game, and then put Sean Cronin in with Devin Toner where he's going to have...
There's a butterfly effect.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be a little bit of reassurance during the game. And if Connor and Johnny are a little bit off or not content with their own game, they might be so self-obsessed about that.
Yes.
But they're not able to actually transmit to the group that everything's going to be okay.
But the self-obsession, which we praise when we're winning and we're this technical machine that steamrolls everyone and we're error-free and 99.9% completion rates, does that work in periods of crisis? Because they are not, to me, and I don't know the men well, even at all personally, that they don't strike me as the lads who'd be able to come out of their own bubble of self-obsession, which is fair enough because they are perfectionists, and to put the arm around other fellas and say, look, let me be your cultural architect. This will be fine.
I think they can, but I think the most important thing you want from them is to get themselves into form. You know what I mean? So if being very obsessive about their preparation...
Get them right first.
Yeah, has led them to being world-class performers, which they undoubtedly are.
No doubt.
Get them back. I think as well, I mean, like, we haven't... Everyone's, I suppose, criticising the halfbacks, but what international halfbacks or elite halfbacks are dominant behind... you know, a pack that aren't dominant.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, that's a massive issue. Our pack aren't producing quality set-piece ball. We're not winning gain line. We're not creating quick ball. So, of course, our halfbacks are going to be under pressure.
What's the etiquette about giving a dirty look to a fellow player during a match?
I think it's fine. If it's the general agreement about it would be that if it's a skill error... or lack of knowing your role error, it's okay. But if it's a genuine, you know, error, well then obviously, or it's about being lazy or not working hard enough, well then you deserve it.
Well, I would agree. I take your point about the playing on the back foot and in front of a pack that's not dominating. But a couple of the errors that maybe the restart from Sexton or a pass that one of Murray's early passes to Stockdale that didn't go to hand, they wouldn't really consider that it's going back, it's something else as well as that.
Yeah, but I mean, if they're getting front football and other stuff is going well, you don't scrutinise that error.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, for halfbacks to be consistently playing off slow ball for the breakdown to be messy. If you go back to the England game, he had four balls, line of balls tapped back to Connor with the English pack coming through on him. I mean, that definitely isn't an ideal platform to play. And then obviously we scrutinise then the individual errors that follow around that. But every 9 and 10 who touch the ball, you know, 40, 50 times in a game, they're going to have those moments. Obviously, the kickoff, he's pushing that. He's trying to get the ball back. You know what I mean? Like, if he's less brave and he just kicks it long, no one ever questions it. But the reason we want to have, the reason we admire Johnny Sexton is because, you know, it's like that crossfield kick to Keith Earls in the dying moments against France.
In Paris, yeah.
So we're praising him for that. That could have easily ended up in the stand. You know, I would have said, what an idiot. But so you can't.
What are we meant
him to
say? Are we meant to just be neutral all the time and say?
No, we're debating.
I think haven't been said, what an idiot. And like, nor should we necessarily. But like, I think with Connor, obviously he's not playing quite where he was. But it has been a few kind of random errors, and they're maybe over amplified because they're so uncharacteristic. Johnny seems to become almost more anonymous. And like, at the risk of being saying the wrong thing, I mean, like, that could be read, was read by many people, I'm sure, as being extremely petulant, coming off the field, kicking water bottles, screaming about catch the ball, a pass that happened 3 minutes earlier to a 22-year-old player. Like, you're kind of...
Well, that was my cultural architect question.
I accept you can't praise him for being a competitor and then bin him for the same thing.
But he's been himself. He's been himself.
Yeah, but, I mean, that it just doesn't tally with the traditional way of thinking about leadership in rugby.
No,
that's where it's one for all for one kind of stuff.
It doesn't, but...
You give him a bollocking after the match.
Yeah, but every...
Privately.
Every successful team has guys who are... very, very different. That stereotypical, you know, one for all, all for one.
Is romantic.
Leader is romantic. Yeah, it's a mixture. You need someone like that. You need someone who's great fun, great crack, calms everyone down.
Well, who's that in the Irish camp? Who's the great crack, great fun?
Cronin's a bit of a character. I don't know.
Probably wasn't in great form Saturday night or Sunday night, to be fair.
You're listening to the RTE Rugby podcast, and we're discussing the Irish malaise, right? Gordon Darcy says they should drink beer on the roof. In fact, most suggestions, lads, seem to be that they can vaporise the lactic acid, the bad mental lactic acid, by getting pissed. Surely that's not the solution. I mean, would the commentariat be recommending crystal meth if it was legal?
No, listen, I think there's more to it than that. I'd imagine the point they're trying to make is you need to get a better balance between, you know, just working hard on the field and putting that pressure and also enjoying each other's company off field. And I think, you know, the Irish team over the last 7 or 8 years have been incredibly tight. I think if you look at, you know, Warren Gatland spoke after Wales beat England about how tight this group is, and, you know, because they won the game, you know, they're celebrating afterwards. You know, there's a lot of feel-good moments. We just haven't really had that in this championship. But look how tight we were in November. And that doesn't come from just the results. I mean, if you look at, like, Christy Moore goes in. They've loads of guest speakers. They do things socially together to make sure that team spirit and cohesion is there. But probably this is an ideal week to do something off the field as well as on. Just
what's
to relax.
Your suggestion? I mean, you've been a coach.
We've gone to Belfast. The Titanic Museum would be good.
That's going to sort it.
No, I'm joking. But I don't know. But it's up to the players to pick and do something. Like, there's also the danger of compulsory fun where,
yes,
you know, you know, you have to go and do archery. Yeah, you know, but if that's not actually what they want to do. But I mean, there's enough senior players in that group to get it.
Are you on a loser, like, when you're thinking about things to this degree already?
No. I'm sorry. I'm not. This is what's been talked about as a solution. I don't think it's only a part of the overall. And they probably would have done something around team building or cohesion this week anyway. I actually think.
Is there any danger that they're getting sick of each other?
Yeah, potentially.
Why don't we say that? Like, I mean, it's fairly normal human emotion.
No, potentially, they're saying, well, look, it's World Cup year. World Cup year. We're going to be together for 6 months. There's a lot of hype, a lot of expectation. We just got to deal with that, and they will deal with it. But
sure,
they got to find the way to deal with it. So maybe the way to deal with that with World Cup year is different than what led us to a Grand Slam last year, because, you know, we've become everyone's probably figured us out a little bit to a certain extent. So
unless we're getting quick ball, we're nailed instantly.
Yeah, I also think that potentially, because we're the reigning champions, or because we're number 2 in the world,
back to the target on the back thing.
No, we don't want. We've gone away from what we're doing. So we want to entertain. No, honestly, it doesn't look like that, but we're playing a lot more in our own half than we have. I mean, against Italy, you know, we didn't kick very much. You know, so they had 14 in the front line. And I understand why we didn't kick a lot, because obviously they want to build confidence, they want to build possession, they want to get their attacking shape right. And you feel, isn't it, even if we're not overly accurate against Italy, we can score five tries from doing that. But the reality is, what made Ireland good was a pressure game.
Yes.
You know, and it was only when we built pressure and the opposition cracked that we opened up to a certain extent. Like, if you go back to Wales, Ireland in the Viva last year, The first half we dominated, we bullied them physically in their 22, but we kicked to get there. Okay, and then we built up a big score. Then Wales came back at us, and at the end, 5 minutes to go, Wales had all the momentum, and then Stockdale gets that intercept. You know, so we weren't brilliant for 80 minutes, but our memory of the game is that dominant first 40, okay, and then an intercept at the end. So I don't think we're a million miles better than everyone else, but a big part of our game was our kicking and our ability to win the ball back in the air. That hasn't worked.
Yes.
Okay, we haven't done enough kicking, and I understand why. But I think if you're going to go to a World Cup or beat those top five seeded teams, I don't think we're going to beat them by playing, you know, this All Black type game.
Do you see it as a technical or a mental issue? Is it more technical than mental, or the other way around?
I think it's
hard to divorce the two.
Hard to divorce the two. They're connected, but
at that,
the problem is if the opposition feel you're not going to kick, you know, and they're in your half, they're going to have more energy. I think as well, if you look at the amount of energy we're expending in our own half has killed our efficiency in their 22. You know, so we used to get into their 22 without using up much energy. You know, so you set up for a box kick in your 10-yard line. The ruck is controlled. It's slow. Right? So you're in blocker position. You put up an inch-perfect box kick. Your winger gets up and either gets it back for you, so you're on the front foot. Or if they catch it, they've got to work back to resource that ruck and a slow ball. And then you're on the front foot. If you try and play your way out of your own half and you don't have the natural skill set, or you're missing Gary Ringrose, or whatever, the balance isn't right, or you're playing off slow ball, or the opposition have too many in the front line, well, then you use a lot of energy trying to get out with ball in hand, and then by the time you get down there, you're not as dynamic. So we haven't looked dynamic in there at 22.
So the malaise, the self-doubt, the self-belief, the confidence issue is solved, whatever way, archery or beer.
No,
it doesn't matter.
Solved. It has to
no,
be
no,
solved.
No, sorry. It is solved. It will be solved. Just
we hope.
We're differing on tense, but let's assume it's solved. Mm-hmm. But we still have a problem.
What's that?
Well, you've just said that, like, we're not forcing the better teams. We're not putting them, we're not making them uncomfortable anymore.
Not at the moment, no. No, we haven't. Even Scotland, we didn't really make them uncomfortable.
No, we saw that.
But
is it recoverable?
Yeah.
What you were saying about, say, the box kick, and you've expended more energy to get into the opposition 22. When people say, like, they throw around things like, oh, have we been found out or that? I mean, people always link that with the notion that we've become predictable to the opposition. Mm. But is there a flip side of that when it's very prescribed what you do, that your own ability to adapt when that doesn't work is compromised? And the kind of the way one loss on the back of 20 victories seems to have prompted such a huge implosion of confidence, we'll kind of back that up a bit, that it's not actually about the opposition reading you, it's about you've trusted in the process, to use the buzzword, for so long that when it doesn't work, you're shell-shocked beyond what you should be by one loss.
Yeah, I think, that's very true. I think if you look at, so what Joe said after England, lack of physicality, lack of energy, and we'd fix that this week against Scotland. So you expected a massive backlash.
Mm.
Like, you expected to bully Scotland. We weren't able to, right? But we won the game. And then the 2 weeks prep for Italy, apparently training was very sharp. They were very confident they're going to go and blow them away. But we didn't. And that's probably what's the problem for Ireland is a lot of teams. So say, for example, France or even Scotland or maybe Wales now and again. You know, so Gatland didn't overtrain the team going into France, didn't overtrain them going to Italy, but then had a massive build-up for England. Okay, and he spoke about afterwards, I told the lads, no one's training as hard as you. But they didn't do it for 3 weeks, they did it for 1 week, right? Mm-hmm. So you can imagine those Welsh players going on the bus to the Principality, feeling confident from the fact that they've prepped differently than they have the previous 2 weeks. They're really well prepped for this game. Mm-hmm. Ireland can't really go to that because we've always prepped unbelievably well, like within an inch of their life. The preparation is everything, right? So we can't get confidence from our prep, really. Mm-hmm. So we got to try and find different ways. And that's the frustrating thing probably for Ireland. Or like France could do it by bringing in two new halfbacks, who young guys, full of confidence, full of skill, no fear. And that gave that made Mathieu Bastereau look brilliant last week, whereas previously he hadn't. So the big thing for us is where we're going to find this
rabbit
performance. Yeah. Once we have it then, it reinforces to the lads that our game plan is, you know, locked in. The way we train is perfect for these performances. And we had a bad game day against England, and we had two days to away from home to refine our mojo. But we would need to find a performance before the end of Six Nations, or else there's going to be a lingering doubt going into the
World Cup. Well, this could play out. I mean, that's fascinating that we actually haven't got a rabbit in the locker.
No, and obviously you don't. Like, you wouldn't. It's very hard to plan that.
When you're relying on execution, though, like Ireland, that everyone's not relying on it, but when you've a very set plan and the strength of it is the repeated excellence in execution, the trade-off for that is that you're 8 out of 10 every week.
Yes.
You're not meant to be volatile.
No.
Whereas with Wales, obviously, there's the potential for a downswing sometimes. But equally, when they need that rabbit,
they get the 9 and a half somewhere else like to they go. Did at the weekend. Yeah.
Whereas our thing, I guess you could say our MO has taken the volatility out of the equation, which 9 times out of 10 is the best option.
It's like a good pension fund as opposed to a millionaire overnight.
Yeah, it's like being a cup team and a league team. We're a league team. Hmm. So over 20 games, you know, our consistency will pay off. The problem is for the Six Nations, it's over 5 games, over 7 weeks. And I think, you know, every team over 30 games will have a little bit of a blip. We're going through ours now under massive scrutiny. But we're not a million miles away from it either.
It's just a World Cup year. This is why everybody is agonising even more so. Yeah, I mean, you can't put it down to just another year.
There's
be
an element of a bit of a news vacuum here as well, to be honest. I mean, the championship is gone after week one. The World Cup is still somewhat in the distance. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm reading columns about Icarus and inner chimps and all this stuff, and you're kind of going,
Are you suggesting the middle class have nothing else to talk about but rugby?
Yeah, I think the kind of culture around rugby leads to a very kind of, you know, navel-gazing approach to how it's commentated on. If this was a hurling team in the summer, it'd be kind of like, the ball's not breaking for them. But with rugby, it becomes the inner chimp and Icarus and all the rest of it. You know what I mean? So there's an element of it that's shite, to be honest. You know, that if Jacob Stockdale gets that pass to Keith Earls, if Keith Earls gets that offload to Jacob Stockdale and you've 7 tries and you win by 35 points, as you say, your memory is 7 tries, 35 points, including one from behind our own goal line.
Okay,
and it's different.
So let's take the second year UCD psychology out of it, and go back to the fact that France next and then Wales. The way I see this is beat France and we have a shot to nothing against Wales.
Absolutely. It's perfect for us.
Lose to France.
Lose to France then is a massive...
If you lose badly in Cardiff, you'll have that nagging doubt. Yeah. If you perform even and lose, maybe it's... Yeah. Redeemable in the World Cup warm-ups.
But if we beat France, Wes, and we go over to Cardiff for the last day with still something to play for, whatever it is, I think that's kind of...
I think Cardiff will be
the
muscle memory game for the squad, though.
Yeah.
That'll be the big
seminal perfect World Cup preparation as well, I suppose, the last big years before they travel.
We have to pay them twice, don't we, in August and September?
Oh, Omar, that's irrelevant compared to what...
Seem to be
what,
nonsense.
What a Six Nations game would be.
Right, yeah. Actually, there is a point, but what is the point to those games? Is that just
match time,
auditioning the first couple for the last couple of places in the squad, and then getting sharp.
Yeah,
but we're probably doing ourselves out of a job here. But Birch can fall back on the corporate speaking, but the rest of us are screwed. But it's like sometimes maybe you just have to accept that they're humans; they have dips in form. You know, I know it's the job and the natural thing is to kind of try and find out why, but 12 years later, after the 2007 World Cup, no one has still put their finger on what happened exactly. So it happened in England a year ago. And even if we were at the top of our game, confident, playing to the best of our ability, just because we won a Grand Slam and beat New Zealand, people seem to forget how fraught some of those wins were. A last-minute drop goal that could have gone wrong 30 times before he struck the drop goal.
I don't think people forget. It's just when that habit is snapped, they get the fear then.
Winning seems to become like almost as if there wasn't a struggle before you won.
But Ireland, me growing up, and I don't know about you, Bernard, probably the same, the other younger lads here, like Ireland used to lose close ones all the time. And then
we'd 60 minutes of fury and then we'd fade and lose.
Throughout sport, Eamon Coughlin coming fourth in the 1976 Olympics. You know, there was always the last minute goal, Vim Kieft in 88 or whatever. We used to do that. But all of a sudden we seem to have cracked that. And now we were actually winning the tight ones and winning the high pressure ones and winning silverware. And I think there's an element of us going...
Yeah, hang on. We've won 2 out of 3. You know...
Yeah.
And like the fairness against Scotland, we were pretty comfortable at the end. The criticism of Scotland was we didn't kick on for the bonus point. So even though we weren't, brilliant, we still won the game reasonably comfortably. And Italy, okay, we got into a bit of a battle, but you still never felt, I never felt we were going to lose the game.
We've so almost
we're not talking about losses. We're talking about one loss and two wins where we weren't as dominant as people would like.
But it's natural because Ireland have set such high standards for themselves, so they wouldn't let you away with not viewing them in those terms, because they reckon, okay, we beat New Zealand, we can beat them again. So they must be analysed in that view. So it's
but there's nothing that high standards about losing to Wales and Cardiff.
No.
We've lost them every second year for the last 10 years, we just said. You know, it's like, it's just a complete false
reality
we're looking at here.
It is, but also, like, it's just great when we win. It just is. I mean, it's just a bit of fun to win and to win trophies. And you don't need to analyse it. You don't need to call it Icarus or Daedalus or chimps or anything. It's just everyone gets a kick out of it. And people then all of a sudden say, I want that kick. Why am not I getting it?
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Don't we all feel in a bit better mood on a Monday after a big win? Yeah. No, too banal for you. Flying too close to the Adriatic instead of too close to the sun. Have you ever flown too close to the sun and felt the wax on your wings melt, Bernard?
No. I keep waving the sun.
Okay, we're wax in people's ears will be melting shortly. Next up, Peter Stringer. Okay, it's time to hear from the ultimate pioneer of body and career maximisation, the rugby ninja Peter Stringer, who's been up and down from Dublin to Cork with his family and has been, of course, playing rugby until very recently in the UK. So the first question to Peter was pretty obvious. So, Peter, where do you live at the moment?
Where do I live? It's a good question. I've been in Dublin for the last 3 months, living, breathing and embracing everything to do with dancing, because moved back from the UK in the summer after retiring and came back to Cork, which was incredible. And you know, our base is in Cork at the moment, certainly.
You and Debbie Noah.
Absolutely. And you know, Debbie said, if you're going to do this dancing, she said, you're going to do it properly. She said, I know you as a person, as a character. If you're going to do something, you give everything 100%. So she said, you move to Dublin, you put your time and effort into that, we'll manage. And to be fair for her, she's been looking after Noah, who is a very, very active 2-year-old, and it hasn't been easy. But you know what? So I got to thank her for convincing me, first of all, to do the show, and then just allowing me that kind of freedom to commit my time and effort into doing it. So it'll be great to get back to Cork to just spend a bit of family time, and
yeah, just be a lazy old daddy again.
Daycare in the coming few days, certainly. Yeah,
I mean, life is good though, by the sounds of it. I mean, it's funny though when you say you came up to immerse yourself for 3 months. It's the Navy SEAL approach to life, isn't it?
It is, and I just find myself, even right throughout my career when I was playing, you kind of meet people and people have these opportunities for you to kind of work with companies. And yes, you want to gain experience in other avenues and prepare yourself for our life after rugby. And that's very, very important. But I think when I was playing, I was that, I suppose, 24-hour athlete. And I wanted to commit myself to that because I'm someone that I live with regrets. And if I don't do everything in my power at that particular time to do as well as I can, then I beat myself up over it. And likewise with the dancing, it was, if I walked away from this not committing the time it needed to rehearse during the week, you know, we had 3 months not having a day off, 7 or 8 hours a day rehearsing. If I didn't do that and didn't perform as well as I could, then I know I would have regretted it. To be honest, for me to do this was, people have asked me to do this for years, and it's the biggest nightmare that I've ever had. So my first day arriving,
to be this kind of half celeb?
Put yourself out there on a dance floor, and to be that kind of, to display this kind of a character. And I'm quite a shy person when you know it comes to, you know, putting myself out there. But when it
comes, are you wary of attention seekers in general?
A small bit. But I think my worst nightmare came true when my first VT day down in Bray in the studios for the dancing show. and you're standing in front of the about 15 people who are the direct creative directors, the producers, the choreographers, all sitting down in chairs in front of you in a green screen area, and they say, okay, we need 20 minutes of freestyle dancing from you to see what you've got.
Freestyle.
You know, and it's like, that is ultimately my would have been my biggest nightmare and fear. And after 20 minutes, they turn around to me and say, would it help if we turned on some music? And it just, so you're there for 20 minutes and they're just give us something. And I'm like, if you tell me and direct me, because it was just so alien to me,
right.
In terms of getting any sort of messages from my brain of how I should think I should look dancing.
There was very little context for
it,
wasn't there?
Very little, yeah, very little. So that was a starting point, and that really kind of opened my eyes to how difficult the whole thing was going
to
be.
Go back to the pilots, because I'd heard that, but I didn't know that you've completed now, you have your civil license or whatever.
Well, I have my private pilot license, yeah.
Like 40 hours, or used to be, what is it now?
So, yeah, so basically, yeah, it took me about, it was actually after the... when I missed out on the 2011 World Cup squad, I went away and just got back to Cork doing pre-season training and did my flying up at the Cork airport. So I did it over 5 months, got my license, enjoyed the process. It was a challenge, and you know, got the license, took my dad up flying around West Cork, and you know, had the freedom to go off and do that, and it was unbelievable. And then moved to the UK and never kind of really followed it up much, and haven't done much of it at all recently. But, you know, that's something that's there. It was more so just kind of, okay, I achieved that, ticked it off the list, and kind of moved on. So it was, yeah, it was just a thing that I set my mind to, and I wanted to do it.
Look, I mean, it's obvious that you're a driven man, and in a healthy way, it would seem to me. But, like, is there... How are you with kind of stillness? How are you with kind of like, oh, sure, listen, it's just a Tuesday, I'll do not.
Nah, it doesn't sit with me at all. And I say that I've had 3 months now of like solid hours rehearsing and trying to fit your own life into it as well, in terms of, because of what I have learned and what's in me from my experiences in life and playing professional sport, of what has gotten me to where I am today in terms of playing at the top level till I'm 40, looking after myself and being fit, being healthy, eating well. That has all been part of, I suppose, years of listening to coaches, nutritionists, performance experts. And for me to live their advice and put it into practice and to see the results at the end of the day. So I'm taking that forward. So even though I've finished playing rugby, not from a rugby point of view, I will carry that forward from a lifestyle point of view.
I can tell that because during the autumn you were on Channel 4 duty. We were presenting the matches for RT, and I looked, and I don't know, did I tell you this, but yourself and Jamie Heaslip anyway, and I think it was Luke Fitz, and I was with my fellow middle-aged men, Brent Pope and Eddie O'Sullivan.
And Stephen Ferris was there as well, a middle-aged man.
Yeah, well, Ferris looks like he'd be fit if he just worked like humping crates.
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
You guys had the gym body, and I looked, and it was like looking at three lower versions of Beyonce's arse. Your calves were just jutting out through your tight, expensive designer trousers. And I was going, these boys, you have now, like, you were a fit, wiry guy always when you were 20, when I remember you playing first. Mm. Now you've turned into a bit of a gym body. I mean, that is just something that's, tell me about your body. Peter Stringer, tell me about your body.
Look, it's always been a part of sport, and being the small guy, I had to work harder than a lot of other guys in terms of trying to.
But you opted later, didn't you?
I did, and it probably got to a point when, you know, 2012, I hit a roadblock in terms of being at Munster, and finding myself fourth choice scrum half. You know, and coming off the back of, I suppose, 15 years with Munster, and you know, playing for Ireland for 11 years, you know, hitting
a wall. You're not going to get resentful because that won't work. So what are you going to do?
No, hitting a wall and seeing that there's no, I suppose, progression plan for you in your position in Ireland, and not getting an opportunity to play, and the options facing you are: do you retire? Because as good as a place that Munster is and has been to me, when you're playing and you're successful, your first choice, you're winning trophies, that's what you want to do. You want to be a part of that, and it's an amazing, amazing place. But when you're on the fringes and you don't get an opportunity to line out, yes, there are times when guys are coming through academies and you need that kind of learning environment to be part of. Where I was at in my career and where I'd come from, I felt I had a lot more to offer. Hmm. And I wasn't content with being that fourth choice, Chris.
For sure. So just in terms of your own, I mean, I presume like the game has been good to you financially without you being a gazillionaire. So you don't have to like turn around and go to the job center tomorrow. But are you going to try and excel in something that's commercial? Or are you going to try and kick back and become a kind of a full-time dad, as you said, for a while? Or
do you know what? I want to be busy, and being a full-time dad, you'd be very, very busy, certainly. But look,
be careful what you say there.
I know. But look, genuinely, I am so passionate about, living a really healthy and happy life, and that for me is my goal. In terms of, you know, a lot of guys, when the day they finish and they retire from rugby, they don't want to see another gym, and they want to just kick back and relax, and that's all well and good. But for me, I cannot sit still. I need to be in the gym for 6 o'clock in the morning. I need to eat well. I need to plan my food. And for me, mentally, that is how I start my day and how I get through it. And how I basically, I see it as future-proofing my life in terms of how I'm going to take this forward. And I want to put together a business of my own where what I've learned over the last 20 years and how I've developed as a person, put that into a business and be that performance person that can go to businesses, that can go to clubs and schools and identify, like, this is what you need to do to get the best out of people in different situations, in looking after yourself in terms from a health point of view, mentally, from how you eat, how you stay fit. That is what has got me. That is me in a nutshell, and going forward, that is how I'm going to exist.
But how do you tell slobs that you know they should adopt some of the Peter Stringer philosophy?
I think people deep down know it themselves. If people, you know, are sitting down all day, people are, I think, in their own minds, they're like, oh, I know I need to do more. But it's finding that, I suppose, trigger that gets people to do it, and it's sitting down with people. It's setting a schedule. People say, I just don't have time. If something is important enough to you in your life, you need to find time for it. Mm. And there is nothing like being healthy. And if we're all honest about it, you know, family and your health are the only things in life that matter. And for me, it's trying to find that way of getting through to people, whether it's sitting down on a Sunday evening for 10 minutes with a pen and paper, and you know your schedule for the week, whatever. People, I know people have busy lives with family, with work, but if something, like I said, if something's important enough to you, write it down. Okay, if you need to do one gym session a day, one cardio session a week, whatever it may be, you write it down. You make yourself accountable for that. If it's written down in front of you within your schedule of your work week, and you see it written down in front of you, it's so hard to shy away from it. If you get to a point where I might go to the gym tomorrow after work, that rarely happens. Mm. So if you write it down, it's factored into your week. And if you miss it, then you kind of go, that's some part of my schedule that I've missed. So that's a basic step. Sit down, write down your week, get things down on paper, and people then, you know, if you do one session, that's one more than you would have done last week. So it's trying to find that trigger,
yeah,
that will make people get up and do what they know themselves deep down they should be
doing.
And
over time see the rewards. Absolutely. They feel more content. The mental health side is indistinguishable from the physical health side. From, am I putting words in your mouth?
Yeah, no, it is. And I think you'd be amazed that if people, you know, you find that time, you get up at whatever time, 6 o'clock, you get up an hour earlier, you do something, you do 20 minutes of something. That is an achievement. That is a goal. That's your result. You can then carry on with the rest of your day knowing peace of mind there that you've achieved something you've set out to do, and the rest of your day will flow. Everything has got a knock-on effect from that, because if you don't do it, things are hanging over. We all know, we all have negative thoughts, and we all think about, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that. You know, if you just do it, if you do, whether it's 10 minutes, whatever your goal may be to start out with, you do it, you've achieved it, you tick it off. Yeah, you can increase your goal then as you go along. But you start with the kind of little goals, the little wins, as I kind of say. So,
how much are you charging for this initial consultation?
The first one's free. But look, it's something that I'm really passionate about. I'm getting, like, I get excited talking about it, because it's so important to people. And if it, like I said, if it's important enough to you, you need to make it happen.
And you're happy to do it in public.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. Peter, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers.
Catching up with you after all this time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Alison Donnelly.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm good. Alison, I thought this week, because it's a rest week, would you mind talking about a couple of things that were on scrumqueens.com, the site there?
No problem, yeah.
The All Blacks thing and four new faces for the Black Ferns was informative, because it gave us an idea of the structure and the hours they dedicate to the game and that type of thing.
Yeah.
So tell us now, if you're a Black Fern, what's your kind of work programme like? What's the union doing for you, and what isn't it?
So they're similar to France in how their contracts are structured. So they're essentially part-time, enough to, you know, give them a couple of days off work and train, you know, 2 to 3 other days. Now, my understanding is that many of them work 3 or 4 days a week and use the sort of money to help them take, you know, a day and a half, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's not anywhere close to England's setup in that they are now obviously fully professional. But you know, it was a huge step in the right direction last year for New Zealand. At the time, you know, leading up to World Cup, they'd, you know, been given scant investment, and they used to win sort of World Cups in spite of, not thanks to, the investment in them. And so, you know, a year ago, that was a big step for them, and they've continued that now with the renewal of 29 contracts for the next year.
As a kind of a branding entity, I mean, we know the All Blacks is the original juggernaut. It seems to kind of keep its mysticism and amateur appeal while being a massively commercial brand. Is that spilling over a little bit for the Black Ferns?
Yeah, I think the Sevens success for the Black Ferns women actually has really sort of catapulted women's rugby into a new, you know, spotlight and a new level in New Zealand. Of course, women's rugby's always been big there. It's such a huge sport, and women play netball, of course, they're at a very high level and professionally. But I think the success of the Sevens team, you know, travelling to the Olympics, yes, not winning, but they won the Commonwealth Games, and they're so good on the World Series, that I think those successes combined with the Black Ferns just continually winning World Cups has really sort of combined to give them a profile that they perhaps didn't have before. And now that you can get paid to play, well, I think we're going to see a lot more from New Zealand in the next few years.
And affection mightn't be the perfect word, but it's not a bad one. I mean, are the Black Ferns held in kind of a national regard?
Yeah, I think interesting, when people realised, of course, they won the last World Cup in Ireland, as everybody there knows. I think there was a little bit of a backlash, actually, that they weren't being paid. And I think once the public realised that there was actually a two-tier system there, where the Sevens girls were getting paid and the 15th girls weren't, and they were still winning things. Actually, there was a bit of pressure put on the New Zealand Rugby Union. So I think, while netball has often been the sport in New Zealand that has really, you know, assumed to be the sport that women play professionally over there as a team sport, I think rugby is catching up, and you know, success will really help that.
Of course it will. And Alison, the other non-Six Nations story, qualification, Olympics qualifications for the Sevens, you mentioned Sevens there, seems to be, the fog seems to be lifting a little bit about what needs to be done.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we've really struggled to get from World Rugby and others, you know, the process of qualification for the women's competition, which is bizarre, really. And I don't think it would happen in the men's game. We, you know, people would demand to know, and we would know. But it's becoming clearer, and I think there'll be a few more chances for European teams to qualify. And, of course, Ireland are doing so well at Sevens now that, you know, qualification is a very real prospect. It will be very difficult. There are some really good teams in Europe, Russia, Spain, England, France, Ireland, of course. But, yes, I think, you know, it's all becoming a little clearer as to what teams need to do now.
Yeah, well, make it clearer for me, if you don't mind.
Yeah, well, there are a number of routes to qualification. So one route is through finishing in the top four at the end of the World Series, and those teams look fairly set in stone now. The other route is through European tournament, and then there's a repechage. So last time Ireland ended up in the repechage, it may be again where they end up this time, and there's one sort of one shot there for a team. I believe it was Russia. Ireland held that tournament actually in Dublin. I remember travelling over for that. It was a great tournament. They did well, but they weren't quite there. So they have a couple of shots to do it. They won't qualify through the World Series, Ireland, but there are two other goals at it. England haven't been doing very well on the World Series. Now, they're focusing on 15 this year, so they're not the foregone conclusion that they were to qualify, actually. So Ireland and France, they're two of the teams I think people will feel like have a great chance of getting those two spots. But Russia, Spain, like I said, and other teams pushing as well.
It would be a giant boost, but when is the next significant date for the Irish women's sevens?
So the next round of the World Series, there's a little break on the series now. So they've got a month or so. I think it's the sort of March, April for the series. So they've got a little break now, which is probably welcome. They did so well last time out, of course, that they've become a team that teams are worried about. And that's a great credit to the sevens programme and the type of players that are coming in to that talent stream, because of course, like the other smaller nations, they don't have the same pool of players to choose from. So they're doing very well, and now they have a bit of rest and recuperation after doing well last time. So it'll be really interesting to see how they go next time out.
Great. Alison, thanks for that. Looking forward to chatting to you next Wednesday in the lead up to the game against France.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Alison Donnelly of scrumqueens.com. Okay, that's it for another week. Hope you can join us next Wednesday on the RTE Rugby Podcast. Just like to thank everyone who helped put together today's programme. Michael, Wes, Peter, Alison, Declan, Bernard, Andrew O'Connor and Dave Gibson. And hopefully we'll talk to you next week. Go easy.